Session number 9797.
Mr. Spearman, reel 5.
Yeah, so this jungle, right down the centre spine of Malaya, with Pahang on one side and Selangor on the other, was really, really deep jungle. And if you don't know your whereabouts in there, then you're seriously in trouble. If you're in a ship at sea in fog, you can imagine it's almost impossible to make way, and it's like that being in a jungle. Where I was in Pier, you could leave the road and go into the squatter areas and go and climb the hill range of mountains there in the jungle. And there I got lost a few occasions. But when you knew that if you went in a certain direction, you're bound to hit the main road, you couldn't go wrong. But to get in deep jungle like this was, you really needed to know your way. And lucky enough, I found out that these Aborigines, the finest thing with the Aborigines, they're sort of a nomad tribe, and they had been all their lives there. And when I say nomad type of person, when they wanted food, in the civilized area, the Malay, the Chinese, would grow their rice paddies in a swampy area and lay down a thing. But these nomads in the deep jungle, I'll tell you how they get their paddies, how they've fed themselves through the years. They go to an area within walking distance of the village where they're living at that time, and they'll look for the biggest tree in the area, and a big tree up there can be 200 foot high or something like that, and have vines hanging down from it, and the most glorious, marvellous trees, and it stops you actually seeing any sun. You can see flickers of daylight, but if the sun is out, you can never guide yourself by the sun, because you never see the sun unless you get a break. And as I say, then they get to find a big tree, and they build a platform up around it for about 10 foot high. And with their billyongs, with their axes, the one thing they used to get from civilization always was axes, metal axes. And they used to make these, I've got little models of them upstairs, of this certain rattan type of wood which has a whip in it. And they build this metal head into it. And the way their axes work, they bring it back and the head of the thing flexes and almost doubles up. And then when you let it forward, when you bring your thing forward, it jerks forward, and they cut a tree down in no time. I couldn't do it in a year, but them pecking away, even on this platform, three or four of them with these things, they get the most enormous trees down in no time. This is how they used to make their boats. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But they'd go up there, they'd knock this one tree down, and in the falling it would drag 5 or 6 or 10 other little trees with it. And in a way, if those trees were gone, you'd have already a cleared area, you know. And they'd enlarge that by doing it somewhere else. Until the end, they'd have a vast area, like a huge field, a vast area of all these broken trees, all fractured and broken and pointing and all in every direction with all the foliage down. And there's no way could you walk through it. It was absolutely impenetrable with it all down. But then they put a match, they come back in a couple of months' time, and in that weather, everything was dry to a frazzle. They put a match to it, and the whole thing would go up in a blaze of flame. And they'd leave it for another month, another couple of months, and they'd come back, and everything was blackened, everything would be blackened, and all the charcoal had gone into the soil, fertilizing it. And then when the time was right, the women would go along with a stick, making a hole in the ground, and the man would come behind and just toss a seed in it. You know, whether it went in the hole or not, it was immaterial. They just used to go around the whole place, wherever they could walk. You know, it all broken up and burnt by this time. They just make a hole and chuck these rice seeds into it. They come back in 3 months' time, and here was a whole field of dry paddy. You had difficulty, I know, moving around the field because of all the burnt and projected dangerous wood still around, but that's how they used to go. Now, the jungle proper, virgin jungle, when you go into virgin jungle, it's the most beautiful place to be, and it's a wonderful place to live because it's like being in a cathedral. You've got these majestic trees going up 100, 200, 300 foot high, you've got the monkeys chattering, you can't see the sun, so there's no heat, you're not in the sun. There's shade, and there's a dampness about it because it's never dry, it's always dampness, but there's a nice spring-like damp feeling where things grow like anything, you know, and that's what it's like. It's like being in a cathedral, well, and years and years of fallen leaves falling onto the floor. It's like walking on an accident of carpet, and there's no difficulty in making your way through virgin forest at all. It's a most wonderful feeling. you do get trees that die and fall naturally, and there, if you're working, say, on a compass bearing, then they are an obstacle and you've got to overcome it. There are a lot of those in the jungle, but the point I'm trying to make here is the virgin jungle like that, with years and years of fallen trees, is like walking on an Exminster carpet, and the atmosphere is like a cathedral-like atmosphere. You've got to forget the leeches on the ground level, and the nasty bees that are where you upset the hive from sometimes as you're walking through the jungle. You can forget the occasional tiger who've never attacked them. 10 years and all that time I'm out there, never attacked. Oh, I've killed a tiger. They never attack you. Elephants are there. They were killed by the terrorists for food when they got hard up and things like that. But the jungle is a lovely place to live. But once these aborigines or anybody then do what I've told you they do to get their rice ladding, then that jungle becomes secondary jungle, and it becomes like a bamboo forest, absolutely impenetrable.
What does ladang mean?
Ladang is a growing area.
A plot.
Yeah, plot, a ladang, yeah. And if you go around the jungle in helicopters, like and osters and things like that, looking for bandit camps or signs of bandit activity, this is what they used to do. You'd often see a spiral of smoke coming out the top of the forest, and that was a giveaway. Sometimes you'd see these clearings, like these aborigines made when they clear the trees. You'd see a ladang there. You could see it was a cultivated area, and they used to direct forces onto these areas, you know. But of course, my object was, I mean, I had hundreds and hundreds of square miles of forest to look after in this area. But what I, of course, did. These aborigines, the Semilai, lived all over that area all their lives. And no matter where you went in this area, there was always somebody who once upon a time lived there. And if an aborigine lived in an area, say all the west of London from Kingston down to Reading, and that sort of area, huge areas we're talking about, they'd know every bloody tree in it almost. You know, I've been out with Malays in deep jungle, and I walk around all day going in a certain direction, willy-nilly, thinking I was being clever, and halfway through the afternoon come back to a bloody tree, I reckon I'd be stopping at a smoke in the morning. And never knew the difference, you know. I learnt a lot there, because if you hang, it's the best way in navigating the jungle to have an aborigine with you. And if you're in a lucky position like I was of resettling five or six tribes, those five or six tribes knew a tremendous area. So if you got information from an aerial photograph or something, there was a clearing or something over there, there are certain ways they could describe it where these, and give me a map reference, say, for instance, even though it bore no relationship to the actual ground because of the swamp in that area, at least I knew where they thought it was supposed to be, and I would then knew which of these Semilai people had lived in that area. And always, it was very hard for me to describe them. I couldn't say give them a map reference or show them a map. It didn't mean anything to them. But what I eventually did there, to the pleasure of the SAS and all the other people I work with, I made maps, reality maps, you know, like where the swamp was and where we all knew Kampong this was and Kampong was that, and we'd work from there, you know what I mean? And any of these army people that came in, that I used to bring in or used to come in, like the SAS, I used to give them an aborigine who lived in the area they wanted to go to. And this is the only way we could have overcome it. But it was such a desperate area for navigation. If I tell you that from Fort Iskander, it was on the highest point in the area, it was 200 feet high. Being a flat, it was a swampy area, and being swampy, it was flat and Pira. And of course, Placing and Pahang and other roads, bloody, you got your ranges of hills, once you got up there, you'd think you're in heaven, it's so bloody high, you know, but here it was low, that was why it was a swampy area. And I've had calls from Kuala Lumpur or Selangor, or Seremban, I mean, from the town of Seremban, which was my headquarters for as far as this fort was concerned, to say, could I help? There was a platoon of Gurkha soldiers isolated on this hillock amongst the swamp, and they couldn't get out of it. And it was less than a quarter of a mile away from the fort. And they called for a helicopter to take them off because they couldn't move. This is sort of, it was a desperate area. And every movement I made, of course, in the main, had to be by little sampan. You know, and you row yourself, or I'd have a couple of, have a boat for three and have two aborigines with me. That was the sort of area it was. You know, within such a short distance of this 200 hill hillock where I'd made Fort Iskander, being the highest point in the area, Gurkha sent out to be helicoptered and out where they were stuck on this little hillock and surrounded by swamp and couldn't move. You know, this sort of thing. Desperate area, it could be very unkind to you if you weren't settled like I were and had all these Aborigine friends who could take me anywhere, who taught me to move wherever I wanted to go. And we built up such a relationship, you know, that a map reference meant nothing to them. In fact, we built up such a reputation that if I say to you that the best, my business was to get intelligence then, once I'd regrouped them, I wanted intelligence. They go out in the jungle, or contact, terrorists make contact with them, I want them to tell me. If they go out and see any new tracks, they come back and tell me. And I used to pay them, they give me information, I pay them money. And with the school, we also started a shop. And one of the things that they sent in was bras for the women. Now, once the girls started wearing bras, because it made them look very attractive, you know. I was never very happy about that, because it meant you got the impression you were living in civilization then, you know what I mean, rather than as they were before. I never thought that was a good thing. And they brought in beads for the girls, you know, so you could get anything done you wanted. You could bribe anybody with anything, because these were all new to them. It ruined them. It ruined them, because, like us with television, we watch television now, we've forgotten how to play canasta. We don't play all the game we used to play, and it's the same with them in there. When they get entertained, when they get clothing, and when they get a shop and all this sort of thing, they don't go out every day setting their animal traps. They don't keep up the things which all, you know, their forebears used to do. So in a way, it did no good opening that shop and bringing in all the rice, so they didn't have to work for a living, as it were. You know what I mean? It really didn't do, from that point of view, any good, although it was working 100% for us. But I go back to what I was going to say before, that if I tell you that the best informant I had for getting information was a deaf and dumb boy. He was a Semmelier. He was about 14 years old, I suppose. Hard to tell the rate. About 14 years old. And we communicate by language. You know, I couldn't do deaf and dumb language, nor could he, but Bandits was that. If you're doing that, you're talking about bandits.
Well, you cross your two
forefingers. On your forehead, yeah. They always wore a badge, you know, on their cap, these bandits.
To show the star on
their caps. That's right. So that's how they first introduced me to this thing. They come in, and you can see by the excitement of their eye white ball, white of the eyes, you know, with him, where he couldn't speak. You could see that he had some information he wanted to give me, because you see his eyes. And he said, where? How far? You know, and he... That was one day, and that was 2 days away.
That's a movement of the hand
downwards? Yes, across like that. How many days away? And he'd go, and it'd be 2 days to get there. He'd just come from there, and he'd seen them, or he'd seen the tracks. And he was bursting with excitement to get the money, or to get whatever we'd said, you know. But it's funny how you can communicate with people like that, really. When we had this shop, at one stage, somebody started stealing from the shop, and it was this deaf and dumb boy. And I rollicked him for it, by gesture, so clearly that he started crying. Yes. Anyhow, he was one of the best informers I had, because being deaf and dumb, he hadn't got the sensibility to be frightened, you know what I mean? Other people would say, but if I give you information, you know, one of the Semmelier might tell the bandits, you know, and the night before, and this sort of thing. But with a deaf and dumb boy, like, they had no inhibitions at all, any information. Well, sometimes he'd tell me that he'd heard somebody talking about the bandits over there, not me, but him and me, and that sort of thing. He was wonderful. Because I was really living on information and patrolling, you know. The only trouble was I had different field forces in every fortnight. And until they had been two or three times, I never got to know the area properly, you know, and it depending on the lieutenant that came in with them, whether they were any good. Some were very active and others were one big bluff. I knew if they met any manners, they wouldn't do a bloody thing anyway, you know, so you were very reliant. And quite honestly, all the information that turned up there in the main, I got it myself or from the Aborigines, you know, but it was useful to get it. I got a constant stream of information by these friendly Aborigines going around. And if I was short of information, then I would get two or three boatloads of Aborigines. I'd get, say, three sampans. And I'd go with a headman, he was the one I always went with, and a young son of his. You rely on them completely. And with the Aborigines, as I say, you can go around a circle in the jungle all day long, and you never know which direction you're going. You can't see the sun. The only way you can travel on yourself is by compass bearing, and you've got to be 100% accurate on it. If you deviate from it, you're lost. You're finished in that jungle, you're finished, because there's no recovery. The only other way is to use an Aborigine, your nose, and with these Aborigines, I never had a problem. As long as I could communicate again where I wanted to go, it was lovely. But if you really got stuck and wanted information, you go out in a boat in the evening time. Now, don't forget, there's no twilight, it suddenly gets dark. So there's a certain period when people have got to start making a camp, where they've got to pack up for the night and settle themselves in and make a meal. They always had a meal. And on water, I was saying this morning, any little spoon or mess tin rattling on water, it goes right across. You can hear it from miles away. We used to go out in these crowds, and again, I've got things upstairs. You've got these paddles which come down to a point, and you put them in the water without making a splash or a bubble. Wide blade, and when you pull forward on them, it sends the boat propelling forward at a rapid pace. There's no leeway on the boat. The water is lapping up on the edge of it all the time. But they're so well balanced, it's unbelievable. Put this diong in, just two hands on the wonder. Put one in there and then that way there. It comes out with that and it's slight drip. Goes in without any effort, and you can keep the boat straight at a terrific speed. But then when you get in a certain position, away from the fort, away from any of the kampongs, you can sit there, bring your paddle aboard, sit there and lay still, and you can hear all sorts of noises. If there's anybody on the edges of that lake, wherever the edge happens to be at the time, you can hear them. On the other hand, if you get in a different position, you see spires of smoke going up in the still night air, where they're preparing a meal for themselves. But always a giveaway was mess tins, dipping it in the water, scooping up water. This really highlighted to me how dangerous it was on a boat, on that river, on patrol. You had to know what you're doing. And of course I instilled this into everybody who came under my command, who had to go up this, go on the Tasip Brer in the boats. But the Malays are all happy-go-lucky people, and they go off in a boat with all their friends, paddling around. I think it's great fun, you know, and they'll bloody chatter and talk away. Never with me, but if they won't get under control. And a voice travels on water like that so easily. And on this particular case, there was an Indian lieutenant in charge of him, an Indian Sikh he was. And a very, very nice bloke. He'd been in a couple of times. He was a friend of mine, a really nice bloke. He brought this platoon in this time. And I told him that there had been rumours of somebody seen crossing the lake beyond Kambut Ringa in a certain place. So I said, if you want to go out and look at it, that might give you the best chance of getting some action, you know. I said, but you know from past that you mustn't talk on the boats, you must keep alert, because there are certain parts of that where it meets the land, on that where the route, it was low water at the time, and you were guided because the reeds were right above your head and you were rowing along this narrow channel in between, you know, with your thing like that, with these reeds. You couldn't see, and then suddenly you come across a clearance and there was the land. He knew where they were, and we knew because we'd done it so many times before. But he got ambushed on one of these places, and he knew the dangers, and I could imagine all these Malays chatting away or smoking away, not taking enough precaution, and opened up fire, and half a dozen of the buggers were killed. I had to go up there to sort it out, you know. Which caused a bit of consternation, because I had to leave the fort then in charge of a Malay, you know, and the thing came through, they wanted to speak to me or speak to somebody, and of course there was nobody there, neither Field Force Commander was there, or I wasn't there, you know. There'd been a bloody ambush, it was all hell let loose, but he got killed and a few of the others got killed. That was the case. Very desperately dangerous. That's why it would never happen with an Aborigine, because he would know. And if it were low like that, if it were higher, you got more view, you got more chance. You could deviate from the channel with your boat. You know what I mean? Or if you knew it was, if the water was low and you knew where you were, you could not come round that way. There weren't many alternatives, but the Abbas always knew a way around. Anyway, that was it. Another night, I can tell you this, we were out, I was just with one fella in this very small boat, water level up to here. We'd paddled our way up to this area again, which was reported to be a crossing place. I kept getting information about this crossing place, and I wanted to I wasn't going to go stumbling around looking for any camps in there, because this was in deep jungle and the bandits would be in gangs of 100. Now, it's no good me with half a dozen arrows tackling anything like that. This is not the point. That would be stupidity. My main object in life was intelligence. And when it began to run dry, you know, when there wasn't any information coming in of fresh tracks here or fresh tracks there, which I would tackle myself, then I'd go out and look for information myself. And I remember this night we went out, and as we were going up there, we saw two or three spires of smoke coming from this island, Bino or something. I've got a map upstairs, I can't remember the name. It was an island, had a special name to it. And from this direction of this, 3 or 4 miles away, we saw 3 or 4 spires of smoke coming up, so we knew there was somebody there, because there's no other humans within 3 or 4 days of there, only bandits. Anybody were there were bandits. And this turned out to be very close where they kept talking about, people kept talking about crossing place. And when you talk about crossing place, one assumes that they cross it by foot. It's a swampy area, but then you get piles of reeds. If you get onto that, you may be able to hop onto the next one in this sort of way. Or there may be a boat in the reeds halfway across, or something like that, where you get into a row the rest of the way. But there was a definite crossing place there, or I'd never seen it being used as a crossing place. But I was with this bloke in this prow, and we knew we'd identified this crossing place, because this is exactly where it should be. All I wanted to give a map reference, because there was some planes standing by to do a strike if we found this gang. And this looked like a gang. And I wanted to go as close as I could with this boat to try to establish how many sort of people were there. A big gang would make a lot of noise before they bedded down, you know, getting ready for the night and this sort of thing. And so here we were. We felt absolutely safe in this boat. We made no noise. We had all the advantage. We knew they were there. They never knew there were any forces in the area at all. And we were gradually wending our way across little patches of water into more reeds, working our way to a place where we'd get a good view of this bank side before the darkness set in, you know, while they were making their meal. And bugger me, if we weren't coming out into one of these things when some bandits in a boat came out into the same bit of water where we were in. Never known it happened before. So I suppose, in a way, there was no way I was going to shoot. None at all. I only had one arrow with me, you know what I mean? One aborigine with me, so I wasn't going to shoot. So each sort of boat looked at each other, and we both disappeared from view as quick as that. So in a way, I was sorry about that, because I didn't want to be... I was obviously white, they could see that, and I didn't want them to get wind of it, you know what I mean? Because there was this airstrike. I can't remember why it was so important about this airstrike. Some gangs had been built up, and I think they'd been in contact with Gurkha somewhere, and they were seen heading in the direction of the Tashir boat, something like that. It was so important anyway, they had an airstrike laid on. So I got back, and right or wrong, I passed the information. There were certainly a largest number of people on this particular island. Fairly distinguishable, I should think, from the air. You know, I gave an exact map reference. So an Air Force working on a map reference, it would be able to pin them down to a square, you know. Anyway, this bombing went in, and I went back a few days later to this area, but we never, ever found any bodies there. But it definitely was the crossing place.
When would this have been, that you had this accidental encounter with the guerrillas on the lake?
It wasn't me, it was this Indian... Oh, you mean this one I'm just telling you about? Well, I don't know. All I can say, McGivory came in 1954, so it must have been in early 1954.
What was his name? McGilvery?
This happened later, yeah. The High Commissioner of Malaya was a chap called McGilvery, MacGilvery. And he visited the fort. And I'll preempt that a little bit by saying that I got word in. Of course, his movements are secret. Because if information got out like it did with Sir Henry Gurney, he was ambushed. So his movements had to be very secret. But I got signals in that the High Commissioner wanted to spend a day in Iskander to meet the Aborigines and to be entertained for the day. So when that happened, I knew this was rather an important occasion. So I doubled up the patrols in the area. I was told to do this in order to make sure there were no bandits lurking around. There was still this bloody gang lurking around. I think that was why the air strike went in. I think they wanted to play around with it. But anyway, for his visit, I laid on 3 or 4 things to entertain him. One, I laid on, I was glad to lay on, the art of making animal traps. I got some of the samurai, who were good at it, to take them out in the jungle and lay traps, showed them how to lay traps to catch various animals. That's one thing. I laid on a circumcision festival. You know, the young lads are about 14 or 15 out there before puberty. When they circumcise, it's a horrific bloody operation. They use bamboo spikes as needles and banana leaves. They sit on banana leaves to catch all the bloody gory blood that pours out. It looks horrific, and it must be horrific at that age, you know what I mean? And that was another thing we laid on. I laid on various things. And the other thing I laid on, another thing I laid on, was a wedding. There was one very beautiful Samurai girl there. She used to... the most beautiful figure as far as I was concerned. She was about 22 years old, and she'd stand upright in one of these prayers with the water lapping over the edge, and she wouldn't wobble. Absolutely, I've got a picture of her standing, she didn't know I've got a picture, it's her standing immobile in this sampan, in the middle of this lake, the profile, the long hair, you know. And she got herself in a family way, so we insisted, the head had seen me, but the chief had seen me about it and said, you know, Rokio, her name was Rokio. And I suggested to him, that's McGilvery, the chief, big white chief was coming in, I wanted to do these things, and we agreed that it was time that she got married. We knew the fella who put her in the family way, so we laid on a wedding, which was quite a ceremony where they made a, you know, made a big festival as far as the samurai were concerned. And I also did a tour, I think, of the one or two of the nearby villages which we'd resettled, you know what I mean? So that was a full day for him. He was coming in the morning. I don't think he stayed the night. I often wonder how we got so much in that day, but anyway, he came in early by helicopter and he must have left late at night. And all this went very, very well indeed. He was very impressed. He had all the newspaper reporters from the Straits Times there, a fellow called Anderson, who eventually then, after that, wrote a two-page article in the Straits Times, and it was all about Fort Iskander and myself in it. And I sent that to my mother, or my father, and now they're both dead, and all that got lost. And I've got a friend in Malay, and I've been trying to get him to get me a copy of this paper for my children, see. But unless you know the date you want, they can't look through it. So I'm hoping if I ever get them there, I'll be able to go to the things. And actually, I know when he came, because he sent me photographs, all the photographs they took, and Anderson of the Straits Times, the photographs he took, he sent me. So I know the date they were there, and of course the article must have come out within 14 days of that, I think. But I can't give them the date, so they won't send me, they won't look themselves. But anyway, that's beside the point. And that whole, all day, all went very well, and he must have been very impressed with my relationships with these samurai, you know, and the way I could speak to them. They're only little people, you know, I'm tall and they're quite small, and they all willingly gave any information to any answer which he asked through me, you know, or whoever he was asking it through. And I eventually got on the Queen's Birthday's Honours List, really, as a result of him going in there, you know. I mean, normally you do your job and nothing like that happens unless you're a commissioned officer or something, or if somebody's pulling for you, you know, your life goes by and nothing happens. But before that day was out, we got some information in from a samurai, from one of these aborigines, that they'd seen smoke from across the water only a mile and a half away. I knew exactly where it was, and they showed me where it, I didn't see the smoke, but they showed me where it come from. Now, before he came in, I'd sent the field force out on a patrol around the area, so there wasn't anybody else there, so I had to excuse myself with him to go because we'd had this information. So I actually left him before the day was finished. And I knew when I came back he would be gone. But anyway, we got to this area where... No, it wasn't smoke. I beg your pardon, it wasn't smoke. It was tracks. Fresh tracks had been found.